Barrett Kohler is a publisher out of San Francisco, which specializes primarily in books about business. They are dedicated to improving the workplace and work. They use as their motto, opening up new space. After being rejected by all the major publishers, John Perkins took his manuscript, which he had been quietly writing since the 1980s, to Barrett Kohler. They bought, and now they have a runaway bestseller to their credit. Confessions of an Economic Hitman is now going into multiple printings, and now the major publishers just completed a major bidding war for the paperback rights to Confessions. What's amazing is that all of this success is occurring without the usual fanfare that accompanies any book that soars to the New York Times bestseller list, not to mention 20 other regional bestseller lists. It begs the question, why? John Perkins, the author, is delivering a message. Actually, much more than a message. He is revealing his involvement in what we all sort of sense, that is, that when President Eisenhower warned against the emergence of a military-industrial complex, he was truly giving us a warning. Many of us sense that people in power, real power, global power, the power that comes with the World Bank, the National Security Agency, the Halliburtons and Bechtels, may get caught up in their power. And that when powerful people who live a radically privileged life dream dreams of changing the world, they can actually do it with the right plans, investment, political power, and when necessary, force. Over the past 40 years, efforts have been made to develop the Third World. Countries like Ecuador, Guatemala, Iran, Panama, Chile, Saudi Arabia. And without exception, these are the nations that seem to inspire the headlines of poverty, conflict, deforestation, terrorism, which seems to follow development. Now we hear of globalization, which presses giant corporations forward into a unified global network of power. The debate about the future of planet Earth rests so much within this framing of the vision. And to many of us, friends of the Wild Side News, who devote our lives to finding some means, any means, to slow down what appears to be an unstoppable destruction of whole ecosystems and forests and oceans and health, to hear that in almost all cases, such outcomes are the direct intent of the grand global developers in their quest of power and wealth, it is shocking. Good guys, bad guys, here is how our guest, John Perkins, opens his book. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know, as I am an EHM. There are many things, detailed questions I wanted to ask John Perkins, but I wanted to ask him about the giant picture as well. And this is a man who has played at the giant level. I cannot stress enough the need for each of you who work for a better, more sustainable world to read this book. It gives us solid ground from which to build a truly better world. So, for the next two segments, we go in-depth with an ex-economic hitman who has put his life on the line to tell this story. John, it's so good to bring your voice to the voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News. Now, some may wonder why your book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, would be featured on a show about nature. But I feel there's no more important book right now to help us understand the why of our environmental dilemma and the hope for a way back to reality on the Earth. Your book is an absolutely fascinating true story, a confession, in which you begin, in your prologue, driving your Subaru Outback into Ecuador's Amazon jungles. You frame the story with that image. Why?
See, you know, you asked a very good question. I suppose it Sydney, it really came from my deep connection to Ecuador. And as I wrote the book, I wrote it over a period of many years. And the final version, of course, I wrote last year, but it had been putting together. And so I wanted to bring it up to modern times, which is Ecuador now. I'm very connected to Ecuador now. And that is where my heart and soul have been for many, many years. And, you know, I suppose if we were Freudian or Jungian, I'm not sure which here, we could sit back and say, I've always had a deep sense of guilt. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Ecuador, and I think I had pretty high expectations of myself at that time, and maybe feel I let myself down a little bit after that, well, maybe a lot after that when I became an economic hitman. And so probably a lot of the work I've been doing with Dream Change, that's the nonprofit, dreamchange.org, you can find out more about it, over the last 15 years, has had a lot to do with that sense of guilt. You ask a very profound question, and I don't have a stylistic answer to it, except it did frame the book, and it did bring it up to modern times, and I think it also went deep into some very important part of my psyche, my heart, my emotions.
I suppose the reason that I posed that as the initial question is because it, obviously the work that you did so much affected particularly indigenous peoples and their lifestyles and their cultures in many parts of the world. What I'd like my listeners to understand is what it is that you were doing that would have that impact really on all these different peoples.
Well, you know, as I was doing it, as I got started as an economic hitman, I don't really think I thought of it in the context of how it would affect the indigenous peoples at all. But as time went on, I certainly saw how that impacted. And I think the indigenous people have had such a tremendous impact on me, as you know from my other five books, which are all about them. And without their help, without having seen it from their side, I don't think I ever would have had the courage to write this book, and I don't think I ever would have had the heart to write the book, or the hope. The book is written out of a great sense of hope. You know, when I wrote this book, I knew I was sticking my neck in a noose. And I'm not suicidal or self-destructive. So I would only stick my neck in a noose if I had great hope that it was going to accomplish something positive. And the indigenous people, with all of their prophecies, from so many different cultures, as I talk about in the book, they all prophesy, so many cultures prophesy that we've entered a time of potential for tremendous transition for human beings to rise to a new level of consciousness and relate to each other and the environment in very different ways. And I have complete hope that we will do that. And I realize that that has to start by a true recognition of where we've come from and where we stand right now today. And part of that recognition involves recognizing what economic hitmen have done, what we've all done, in essence, to create this empire.
So many of the indigenous peoples and the rainforests and around the world, the natural systems have been impacted from development. And, of course, that is very much what your job as an economic hitman was involved in. Now, some people would suggest that it is just sort of the product of greed and corporations and unfettered quest for wealth. Your story presents a very different picture, that it isn't just sort of accidental or inconsequential, but that as a matter of fact, it was willful. And that's a very powerful aspect of this story that leads to your using the term confession. Share with us the nature of that willful effort to impact these people.
So it's a willful impact to create an empire. And to become powerful and wealthy. You know, I talk about the corporatocracy. In the past 40 years, we've created the first truly global empire in the history of the world. And we've created it primarily without the military, through economics. Another unique aspect of this empire is that it has no emperor, no king. Instead, it has a corporatocracy. It doesn't really matter who's president of the United States, whether he's Democrat or Republican. The corporatocracy is still there and very, very powerful. And so the corporatocracy has set about creating this empire, and they have a lot of knights, a lot of soldiers out there doing it for them. I was one of them. So I don't think it's definitely, you know, I don't know if you could say it was a willful attempt to destroy indigenous peoples around the world. It was a willful attempt to create an empire. And in so doing, those indigenous people, many of them have been destroyed, just like with all the other empires. When the Roman Empire was created, they destroyed a lot of indigenous empires. But I think their goal was to, a lot of indigenous people, but I think their goal was to create an empire, not necessarily, maybe it's a very fine distinction I'm making here.
Well, no, you know, to be honest and fair, you're absolutely right. They did not, your book does not suggest that they had a willful, they were willfully setting out to hurt people. But there was certainly a willful attempt to economically control them. And that meant their resources, their lifestyles, and ultimately bring about change in their countries that perhaps never would have happened if it weren't for their efforts. This is part of what corporatocracy is about. And, of course, the involvement, for example, with the World Bank and major American corporations is part of that legacy. And it's quite shocking, quite honestly, for a lot of people. A lot of people are going to have a very difficult time accepting your story about, in essence, the way in which the World Bank and the NSA and Halliburton and other corporations colluded to bring about economic catastrophe in some of these countries.
I agree with you that people probably do have a hard time accepting it, but I'm not suggesting anything very radical here. To be honest with you, I'm rather surprised actually at what an amazing reaction has been to this book, because the former chief economist of the World Bank and the winner of the Nobel Prize, Joseph Stiglitz, has written about the same sorts of things. And so does Jeffrey Sachs, a very well-known economist. Many, many others have, and criticizing the work that the bank and the IMF do and saying, very much what I do. The difference, perhaps, is that I tell it as a personal story, and I was a guy down in the trenches. I was out there, you know, kicking the wheel, so to speak. And in a way, my story is probably a bit more romantic than theirs, because they were running the organization, sitting in offices in Washington. I was out there in the trenches dealing with the Claudines and the Paulas and all the other things. But I tell it as a personal story. They write their books, for example, Stiglitz's Globalization and Its Detractors. They write their books much more academically. But they say very much the same thing. So this information about all the deals that we struck, like Saudi Arabia, what happened in Panama and Colombia and elsewhere, that's available through many sources, and I footnote many of those sources in the book. So it really shouldn't come as any surprise to people. I think it does because most of us, most Americans, don't really pay much attention to what's going on in the world or at the World Bank. We need to. One of the reasons I wrote the book, you know, is it really important to our children what conviction Scott Peterson got today? And yet we spend a tremendous amount of time on that, and Michael Jackson and Martha Stewart and all these things that really don't have much of an impact on the future of the world, if any impact on it. But what we're doing in these other countries has a huge impact, and a huge impact on us. People are angry at us around the world because they know that we've been exploiting them. And that's made this world a very unstable and unsafe place for us and for our children. We're not going to solve that problem. We're not going to make ourselves safer by increasing the number of security guards at airports or on our borders or by sending more troops abroad. We're only going to take care of this problem when we really hark back to our own ideals of creating a world for the people, of the people, and by the people throughout the world, rather than one that's for the corporations, of the corporations, and by the corporations. That's what we must do. But, you know, the information in my book is I don't uncover anything that a lot of other people haven't written about in different ways.
Yeah, this is kind of interesting, the way in which people have responded. Your book is on the bestseller list in 20 different categories, and I find that interesting, that I think people are hungry for the truth because there is sort of, from my perspective, there's a disconnect between what we observe in our world out here, even, you know, in America, and then what we seem to be hearing from, in particular, our media about what that truth is. And, of course, that, as you paint such a vivid picture, is part of the enormous problem, is the way in which, and by the way, I just want to make clear, I am not at all anti-corporate. Not at all. I think we're going to work our way out of this through right corporatocracy, you know, through proper economic empowerment of ourselves and our visions and our dreams. That is how we must do it. But there is, at this point in time, a rather tight-knit collusion at some levels between the media, between certain corporations, between certain leaders and politicians, and it's a very difficult thing for us who are looking for a better world to really face up to in effect.
It's true. We need to become more educated. you know, I'm struck by the fact that so many Americans have believed that foreign aid is altruistic, when for the most part it is not. It's there to make the, it's been used to make the wealthy of this country wealthier and the wealthy of many of these other third world countries wealthier also, and actually more than double the gap between rich and poor in the last 40 years. This statistic shows that. They actually, the ratio between the wealthy, the ratio of the wealthy to the poor in the world has gone from 30 to 1 in 1960 to 74 to 1 in the late 1990s. And that's terrible. And so we've created this situation. And most Americans don't get it. We don't understand that. Unfortunately, we don't. And unfortunately, most of the rest of the world does. So I just came back from Costa Rica. I was in Brazil earlier this year. I was also in Tibet and Nepal earlier this year. I travel around a lot. And I find all over the world, illiterate peasants know what's going on much better than we do. They may not read the papers, but they know, they hear that their country was just given a huge loan from the World Bank, and they see that big U.S. corporations are there building huge power plants, and it's, and the power plants are going to feed the wealthy people's industries in their country, and the big shopping malls, but they don't benefit at all from this. But they also know that their country is left holding a huge debt. And so instead of paying for health care for them or education for them or other social services for them, a lot of the national budget is going to have to go to pay off that debt. And it makes them very, very angry. These are good, honest people. These are not radicals. These are not socialists or communists or terrorists. But they're very upset with what's going on in the world. And we need to be more like that. We need to understand what's going on in this country. We need to be upset. We need to be skeptical. And I think the appeal of this book, and you're right, I mean, it shocked me, Sydney, how it's just risen to the top of the charts. And like you said, every major newspaper has it on its bestseller list in this country. It has been for a couple of months now, and it's only been out since November. That indicates people really want to know about this. And they're not really interested in reading academic treatises on it. They want to hear the story that's out there from a personal standpoint. And I guess this book has struck a chord with those people. I just hope that people will really listen, and then will educate themselves more. Buy some of these other books. Buy, you know, Joe Stiglitz's book and other ones, and really find out what's going on, and talk to their friends and neighbors and family about it.
I encourage all readers to read the book. It's a fascinating read. I mean, it's a drama. There's suspense. There's intrigue. You even talk about the fact that in some cases, in certain countries, certain leaders who have tried to stand up to this process of economic enslavement or entrapment or however you want it, whatever term is appropriate, have paid the ultimate price. You talk, for example, about Panama. This can go to quite an extreme.
Absolutely, yes. We were always aware as economic hitmen that if we failed, which we didn't too often, that in the background lurked the jackals, who are CIA-sanctioned assassins, usually working for private contractors as we did, not directly for the CIA. But in Panama with Omar Torrijos and in Ecuador with Jaime Roldos, we failed. The economic hitmen failed. I failed. And so the jackals came in, and both of those men died in fiery airplane crashes that there was no doubt in my mind and in most people's mind that they were assassinated because they opposed our policies and would not be brought around by the economic hitmen. We've also seen the next step where the jackals fail, the economic hitmen and the jackals fail. That's what's happened in Iraq. And on the few times when that happens in the world these days, then and only then does the military go in, and that's exactly what happened in Iraq. We tried to bring Saddam Hussein around, tried to get him to buy into the same model that the Saudis had bought into, but he wouldn't buy in the 80s. And so we tried to assassinate him. His security guards were too good, he had too many doubles, so we sent in the military. But do you think for a moment that the military couldn't have taken Saddam Hussein out in 1991? I mean, we could have taken him out, but we didn't want to. Because he was a strong man, he could keep his country under control, and he was a very good shield against Iran. So our best option was to keep him alive and destroy his military, make him our puppet, basically, like the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia. We destroyed his military, thought we'd make him our puppet, but he didn't buy then either. The economic hitmen couldn't bring around, and the assassins couldn't get him, and so finally we had to go back in once again, and this time we took him out.
You know, a question that I keep trying to resolve for myself is, where is the source of this? In other words, there are some, certainly some historic roots to this going way back, and you talk about that very effectively in your book, that the roots of this really come from sort of an altruistic, at least at some levels, desire to uplift humankind, to bring civilization to the wild lands and the the backwoods peoples. Give us a little sense of perhaps how that has morphed through time and try to bring it into the current era, because something has gone terribly wrong.
Well, yeah. You know, I think the roots you talk about are there. There's no question. But from almost a more immediate standpoint, at the end of World War II, we were very scared people and very anxious. We'd gone through World War I, our fathers and grandfathers, at least my father and grandfather, World War I, the Depression, and then World War II. So as World War II is winding down, we create the World Bank, IMF, and their sister organization as a way to rebuild a devastated world, a devastated Europe and devastated Asia. And in fact, they did a pretty good job, but they immediately became politicized because at the same time, a new enemy was emerging, the Soviet Union, and it had nuclear weapons. It was very frightening to us. So we used the World Bank and the sister organizations not only to rebuild devastated parts of the world, but to prove that capitalism was better than the Soviet alternative. And that resulted in a very cozy relationship between these big banks and the capitalist organizations, the corporations. And again, it sort of started innocently enough, but over time, this cozy relationship became stronger and stronger. Eventually, we reached détente, the Soviet Union dissolved. Then the relationship became purely one of building this empire. But from the very beginning, it was part of that. It was to show that our way was better than their way, and in that process, to basically build up a capitalistic empire around the world. And the United States became the logical leader of that empire. We're not the only ones involved, but we're like the coach and the captain. You know, out of the 100 largest economies in the world, 51 are corporations, not countries, corporations. And 47 of those are U.S. corporations. So we're very much the leader in that process, which began, I think, quite innocently.
It helps to know the whys of the wastage of wonder. When we return, we continue and then look to ways to turn this around, if we can. This is the Voice of the Earth, the Wild Side News. The truth shall set us free.